Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. When legal problems go unresolved, they multiply. You know that's true with even something as minor as a parking ticket. But when it comes to the issues often facing low-income military veterans, when legal problems multiply, they can create insurmountable barriers to success after service. A new program has been established in Ohio to address that issue. It's a national program, and Ohio has tapped into it. Joining us now is Angela Lloyd. She's executive director of the Ohio Legal Assistance Foundation, which funds the legal aid societies in Ohio. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Also joining us is Robert Abdullah. He's a fellow with the Ohio Legal Assistance Foundation. He is a Central Ohio native who served 5 years in the Army with 2 deployments to Iraq to his credit. He is a fellow, with the Southeastern Ohio Legal Services. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
All right. So, Angie, the Southeastern Ohio Legal Services is just one of 7 groups in the state participating in this project. It's called the 2013 Equal Justice Works AmeriCorps Veterans Legal Corps. Let's not say that again. Tell us more about the need for this benefit.
Well, Ann, in Ohio, we have the 6th largest veteran population in the country. And what we have found is, and what we found around the country is, that veterans often come back and face a panoply of legal issues that make it really challenging for them to integrate successfully back into civilian life. So they can face domestic issues, they can face benefits issues, they may come back and want to attend college under the GI Bill, and they learn that they're discharged. Character is not what it needs to be, and so they need to get that upgraded. So they face just this panoply of problems that causes them to struggle to integrate and live healthy, successful civilian lives. And so we wanted to respond to that by bringing as many lawyers as we could into Ohio to help.
Why? I've asked this question before. Maybe you can finally answer it. Why doesn't the military help them before they leave service?
Well, I think the military tries to provide information, but, you know, people's lives are individual. And so when they come home and there's a custody issue, or they come home and there's a credit card issue because someone fraudulently obtained their credit card, you know, the military can't fix all those individual issues. You need a lawyer to help you sort through those things in your individual circumstances.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking with Angela Lloyd. She's executive director of the Ohio Legal Assistance Foundation, and also with us, Robert Abdullah. He's a fellow with the Ohio Legal Assistance Foundation, Southeastern Ohio Legal Services. How many veterans are we talking about who really need this service? You said Ohio has the 6th largest population.
Right. So Ohio has about 878,000 veterans living in the state right now, and we estimate that about 61,000 are living in poverty. So we're looking at 61,000 people who have served their country meritoriously and who have come back to find circumstances that prevent them from living self-sustaining lives.
61,000, that's a lot. And we're talking about 7 of these installations, that have popped up. And this is just in September, right?
That's right.
What were they doing before then?
Well, again, that's why we've seen the homeless population grow by about 22%. They were suffering. I mean, I think there is a real need for service, and that's why the foundation has stepped in.
And how many people are being helped now since September? Do you have a handle on that?
We don't yet have a good handle on that. Since the program is so new and the vet's attorneys, the legal corps, have just gotten up and running, we don't have any good numbers yet.
Robert, what is the role of the Veterans Legal Corps Fellows? What do you do?
I think it depends on what your office is and what the need in the locality. But I want to try to help veterans find and preserve a home, get the benefits they're entitled to, and remove any barriers they might have to employment.
So why not just have the Legal Aid Society of Columbus take on the grant and do the job, Angie?
Well, there are 2 reasons. I mean, one, the legal aids, tragically right now, are experiencing one of the worst funding crises we've ever seen. The legal aids rely on income that is hugely depleted at present, and so they don't have the capacity to bring on 7 new people. The other thing is, by creating an Ohio Vets Legal Corps, we can provide specialized training and support and have a whole cadre of lawyers who specialize in vets issues.
Okay, so Robert Abdullah, in October, you attended a leadership and development training conference. What did they teach you there?
Well, I got to meet other veteran Legal Corps fellows, and I got to hear their challenges and what they've done to resolve those. So I get a lot of different anecdotes to work with. And besides that, it's inspiring. Sometimes you're working with maybe a difficult situation under stressful circumstances, and when you can be inspired by other people who believe the same things you do, that's helpful.
If you have a question or comment out there, they're not here to give legal advice over the air, but if you have a question or comment about the program, you're welcome to give us a call, 614-292-8513. Or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. If you want to learn more about this later on, we'll post a link to their website at wosu.org/allsides. So, Robert Abdullah, what are the requirements to become a fellow?
Well, you need to be an attorney, and that's it. But I also think it's important to have empathy for veterans' issues, and some credibility always helps. So being a veteran is a plus, but not required.
I was surprised it wasn't required. Angela?
No, again, we think that attorneys can help anyone. And so, again, it's a plus to have empathy. And we think that most legal aid lawyers do.
So, okay. Did you find that most of the other fellows are veterans?
Well, there are only 7 out of the 36 nationwide that are veterans. But 2 of them are here in Ohio. And the ones that inspired me the most, and I thought that were at least the most competent at navigating the issues affecting veterans directly, were other veterans, because they understood the problems because they had experienced them themselves.
Well, did you experience any problems? You're very successful. You went to law school. Is it Tulane or?
Vanderbilt.
Vanderbilt. well done. So.
Yes. So you learn a certain skill set in the military. And in my case, I was a fire team leader or a squad leader with an infantry platoon. But that skill set doesn't always translate to civilian life. While I could deal with problems affecting certain soldiers in my team or squad, I couldn't use those same skills to deal with problems with my wife or a grocery clerk.
Okay. Do veterans' claims with the Department of Veteran Affairs fall into one of the categories that you cover, Angela?
Oh, absolutely. That's one of the things we really want to focus on, because it's one of the challenges for vets. We ask them to serve the country, and we tell them that there are benefits that are available. And we find that too often they come back and those benefits are harder to access than they should be. So that is one of the services our attorneys will be providing.
Is there a function to this program that calls on you to try to find ways to solve some of those problems with Veterans Affairs, to identify trouble spots and from the Veterans Affairs point side, and see if you can't fix things so that these kind of things aren't so necessary?
So yes and no. Always when legal aides are working with folks on issues, when they identify issues that are systemically problematic, that's part of what legal aid will do, is they will either put all those together and then reach out to the administration to try to resolve things, or in a worst case scenario, they might come to bring a lawsuit to correct it if it's necessary. But again, I think that some of these things are not systemic per se. Some of these things are individual. So again, you have individuals who are discharged under a certain category, because unbeknownst to many people, there are a whole range of discharges between honorable and dishonorable. And depending on your discharge category, your benefits will vary. So it's not that there's a problem. It's just that sometimes you have to get the person sorted out with the appropriate discharge level, and you have to get their discharge upgraded in order for them to be able to get the benefits they were expecting. So it's not that it's necessarily a systemic problem.
And to what extent do medical issues and mental health issues come into play in what you do, Robert?
I think mental health issues especially will affect your ability to cope with any kind of problem. And legal problems are complicated, and when what we would call a simple problem is unsurmountable because of a mental struggle, then the legal problem becomes even more onerous and intimidating.
I call it bureauphobia myself. I can't stand it, but when you have a mental illness, when you're injured, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. It's even worse. What other areas of law do you practice on their behalf besides the Veterans Affairs issues?
We handle everything that legal aid lawyers would normally handle. So we could do housing and employment or family law, custody issues. Sometimes that can be something that is keeping a veteran from being a successful member of civilian life.
How are you going, Angela?
Oh, if I may, Ann, one of the things that we think is really beneficial to having the Veterans Legal Corps situated within our legal aids is that if there are other issues that come up, they can work as a team with the other legal aid lawyers. So the veteran is not limited to just the Veteran Legal Corps lawyer, but in fact has access to the entirety of the legal aid.
And is your constituency just limited to the veteran, him or herself, or do their families benefit from this as well?
Their families, their children, all of that that's connected to the veteran, we can help.
And we are so very excited because a huge part of what we do for the vets is, in fact, by stabilizing them, you stabilize the family. You enable the kids to stay in school. You enable the wife to work. Robert has an instance. He's been working with someone who, as a result of stabilizing the vet, his elderly mother was able to move in with the family. And so it has tremendous impact.
We have an email from Hal. He asks, what services do you offer to homeless vets in trouble with the criminal justice system?
Well, we don't handle criminal issues per se, but there's some things that we can help. For example, expunging a criminal record that might be a barrier from finding housing or employment.
You can help them work on that.
That's correct. We can also help with a discharge upgrade. So, for example, if you have a general or another than honorable discharge, and that's keeping you from a benefit or get into a certain housing situation, we can file an appeal to raise that.
When you left the military, I'm sure you left honorably discharged, but to what extent does the military explain what the different variations on the theme of discharge are, if it's that much of a problem?
Well, I think pretty quickly veterans get an idea of what their status means for them when they try to do something and they're not able to do it. If that happens, we encourage them to reach out to their local legal aid organization and we can explain it more thoroughly.
Most Ohio veterans, about 60% fall into the senior category.
Right.
And likely that percentage will rise as the population ages. What are the most common problems for seniors?
So seniors, unlike the younger vets, face Social Security pension issues, Medicare issues. They can have health care issues, housing, so they're much more likely to own their own home and may face some of the foreclosure. We served, as you may know, Legal Aid served over 4,000 vets prior to starting the Ohio Legal Veterans Corps. And so there are vets, like everybody else, suffer the dangers of predatory lending and of all the mortgage servicer problems.
When you're enlisted, when you're in service, and you know that there's a legal problem brewing back at home, say it's your identity theft issue or a stolen credit card or something's gone awry, is there anything that the military offers people who are, serving active duty, help with legal issues?
Well, we have an instance, and we're very excited to help a young female veteran who was actually in Iraq at the time. She had two children and a husband, and they were living in her family home in southwestern Ohio. And the husband was arrested twice for DUI with the kids in the car. And so the military responded by allowing her actually to come back to address those issues and to be the custodial parent for the children. Once she got back, she found out that the husband had forged her signature and she was losing the home. She obviously didn't want to remain with him because of historic domestic violence issues. And legal aid represented her and very happily got her custody of the kids, got her a protection order, and got her house back. But the military was completely cooperative in allowing her to come back to resolve those issues.
So how does a veteran know if he or she qualifies, Robert?
Well, we encourage veterans who think they may or may not qualify to reach out to the local legal aid organization and let us determine if we can help you or not. Generally, it's low-income or homeless veterans. That income guidelines change, but for example, a household of four, the income limit will be $23,550. But once again, if you're not sure you qualify, please reach out.
You mean you can't earn more than $23,000? That's like way that's...
But that's the 61,000 people. I mean, they are below the poverty level.
Many people.
Yes. Although it's an astounding number, the tragedy is that there are 61,000 vets living below that level in Ohio.
Well, it's called, once again, the 2013 Equal Justice Works AmeriCorps Veterans Legal Corps in Ohio. The funding is administered by the Legal Aid Society of
Ohio Legal Assistance Foundation.
Ohio Legal Assistance Foundation. If you want to learn more about that, we'll have a link to their website at wosu.org/allsides. Angela Lloyd, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Ann.
Angela Lloyd, she's Executive Director of the Ohio Legal Assistance Foundation. And also Robert Abdullah, thank you as well.
Thank you.
And can we just, as a final word, say we'd love for vets to reach out?
Yes. Robert is a fellow with the Ohio Legal Assistance Foundation. Once again, you can find a link for more information at our website at wosu.org/allsides. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Some call it Burma, others call it Myanmar. It is a sovereign state in Southeast Asia, bordered largely by China, India, Laos, and Thailand. Far from us, yes, but because of its recent history, debilitating military rule, and now a burgeoning young democracy, U.S. interest has grown and grown quickly. Joining us now to talk about that is Priscilla Clapp. She served in the U.S. consulate in Burma for 6 years, three of which as chief of mission. She is currently advising the Asia Society and the United States Institute of Peace Rule of Law Center. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Anna. I'm delighted to be here.
The transition in Myanmar is top-down, apparently led by the president, a former general, and as you point out in a recent report for the Asia Society, an unlikely reformer. And I was wondering, what do we know about him that would give long-term credibility to this turnaround?
Well, the president, Thein Sein, was one of the major leaders in the last military regime. He was, in fact, he served as prime minister. But of all of the generals, he was the one that was the least corrupt, probably not corrupt at all. He had the most integrity. His judgment was the most respected. And he came from a very poor rural background, and he was a self-made man. And the military was the way to advance oneself in the old days. And so it's really, to me, kind of surprising that he came out on top, because I had expected that one of the more corrupt, ambitious generals would come out on top. And he was always reluctant. He was reluctant to be prime minister. He was not pushing to be anything in the new regime.
He was elected.
he was elected to the parliament. The way it works there is you run for the parliament. The parliament then elects the president. The president is not elected in a popular election.
Okay.
And the parliament, in order to elect a president, divides into three parts. There's an upper house and a lower house, and each house has 25% uniformed military representatives who are appointed by the commander-in-chief. You see, they wanted to make this transition a very gradual transition from strict military rule to eventually total civilian rule. But they didn't trust civilians to take over the government right away. So they decided they needed to have the military involved in this transition all along. So they put 25% in each house military to keep them there. So they the two 25% groups from each house come together, and that's one group, the civilians from the lower house and the civilians from the upper house. Each one of those groups nominates a candidate for president. And then the parliament sits as a whole, a joint session, and they vote on those three candidates. The one that gets the most votes is president, the next one is first vice president, the next one is second vice president. So they all win, but at different levels. They then move over to the executive branch, and it becomes more like our government. Separation of powers between legislative, executive, and judicial.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is Priscilla Clapp. She's a retired minister counselor in the U.S. Foreign Service. She served in the U.S. consulate in Burma.
Embassy.
I'm sorry, the U.S.
It was an embassy.
U.S. Embassy.
It is an embassy, yes.
In Burma. Okay, sorry about that. For 6 years, three of which as chief of mission. If you have a question or comment about Burma or Myanmar, how does the United States officially refer to the country?
Well, we're bipolar.
Yeah. Burma's just easy, and it's what I grew up with. But Myanmar, I finally can pronounce it, so I want to use it.
Well, for many, many years, we made a political statement by calling it Burma, because that's what Aung San Suu Kyi wanted it called. She felt that the name change was illegitimate because it was done arbitrarily by a military government. She felt it should have been voted on by the people or done by an elected government. So she has always had problems with the way the name change was made. Myanmar was always the official name for the country, the formal name for the country, but it wasn't used in popular speech. They called it Bama. Bama, Myanmar were both, that was the name of the tribe that originally came down from Tibet that became the major nationality in the country, Bama. Burma came from the British turning into English.
Anglicized.
The word Bama, anglicizing of the word Bama. They spelled it B-U-R-M-A, you know, the British pronunciation, Bama.
Okay.
Myanmar is so often mispronounced by English speakers. It's a very difficult word to say. It's actually just two syllables in Burmese.
Myanmar.
Myanmar. Myanmar.
Okay.
Myanmar. And so I prefer to say Burma simply because it's easier to pronounce and it's easier to understand. The way that English speakers mispronounce Myanmar makes it almost unintelligible to Burmese. When they hear it, they don't really understand it. Myanmar, Myanmar, so forth.
So at this point, does it offend anybody one way or the other? Or?
Excuse me. When I'm there, I use Myanmar. But when I'm here, I use Burma.
Okay.
Because people identify, you know, people in the U.S. identify more with the word Burma than Myanmar.
The president visited Burma a year ago. What was the significance of that visit? It was the first time in 50 years, I think, that a sitting U.S. president
had
visited.
The first time ever.
Ever.
That a sitting U.S. president had visited there.
Why then and why never before?
During 50 years of military rule, which is almost the entire post-colonial period in the country. Post-World War II. Mm-hmm. It was 100 years it was under British colonial rule. It was part of the Indian Raj. And it became independent at the end of World War II. It had a democratic government, an elected government for about 14 or 15 years. And then there was a military coup in 1962, and it remained a very harsh military regime from 62 until 2010, actually 2011, when they ceded the new government. So that's a long time, yeah.
And so why last year?
Because during the military period, we had a ban on high-level visits to the country. Nobody, when I was there, the highest-level U.S. official that was allowed by Washington to visit the country was a deputy assistant secretary.
Well, what was that like for you to be there and not have the status of those kind of state visits?
Actually, it's nice.
Okay, I get that.
Because those state visits are a pain in the neck for an ambassador. I was chargé because they didn't allow me to carry the title of ambassador. The Congress didn't allow it.
Okay.
So I had to be called chargé d'affaires, which is, it's the ambassador equivalent.
Okay.
Because we always had a full embassy there, but we just didn't call the ambassador.
So when you're chief of mission, ambassador.
Ambassador is a chief of mission.
Okay.
Yes, yes.
We were confused about all those technical terms.
Oh, it's very difficult. It's crazy. They should just say ambassador, but yet I didn't legitimately carry the title, so I don't use it. But so, at any rate, what I was going to say is that when you get a visit by a president or a cabinet secretary or something, a very huge retinue, an entourage comes with them. The Secret Service, they even fly in the cars, everything. And it is a pain in the neck. I was in South Africa for the Mandela transition as deputy ambassador, and I know what it's like to get huge state visits. It's wild. It just occupies the whole embassy. It's a kind of, there are so many better things
distracting
to do.
Right.
So it was nice. In a way, it was nice. And the other thing is that in a situation like that, the embassy then becomes much more important in the policy process in Washington because you have, you're the ones that have the information. Nobody else can come and get it.
You kind of span a couple different generations of governance in Burma. Was the change back in 2010, I guess, was that when the big changes
started?
Well,
the election was in November 2010.
Okay.
Right?
Were the changes palpable? Were they noticeable to, well, you or what about an average citizen?
I knew the transition was coming because they had been planning it for 20 years. But people here didn't believe it. They thought, oh, it's just an excuse for them to make military rule legitimate in a modern times in that country. Because they were a member of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, which we call ASEAN. And we, the United States, were kind of sanctioning ASEAN for having taken Burma in as a member.
Huh.
And so people here felt that they were just trying to legitimize their military rule with this veneer of elected government, that it would really just be military by another name. I didn't think so because I could see that they were working on a constitution, and I knew they'd been ordered to return to multi-party government, multi-party parliamentary government by the military ruler who'd staged the coup in 62. So they were marching ahead, but it took them 20 years to write the right constitution, to make the plan that they needed to make so that it would be stable, transition from military to civilian. They wanted it to be a kind of a long, drawn-out, stable transition. And so we didn't expect much at first. We thought it was going to be very slow. The new parliament was elected in 2010. It was seated in late January of 2011, and they elected a speaker of the lower house, speaker of the upper house, and all of those. And then they elected a president in March. They seated the president at the end of March in 2011. He gave his inaugural address, I think, on the 31st of March. And that's when the fireworks started, because unexpectedly, in his inaugural address, he announced a major program of political and economic reform and basically admitted that the military years had been a disaster. He didn't do it in those words, but so people said, what is he talking about?
Sounds like the new pope.
Yeah, and they didn't believe it. So he gave the speech two more times over the next couple of months, and he named three civilian advisors, which, of course, the military had never done. One was an economist who was also advisor to Aung San Suu Kyi. And that
Nobel Peace Laureate.
Yes. Democracy icon, we call her.
Yes.
Who had been held in house arrest in detention for many, many years because she was a threat to the military government. Her father, General Aung San, had been the founder of the Burma Army, of the original independent army. And then he stepped out of uniform and became the founder of the independent state and the democratic government. Unfortunately, tragically, he was shot before the original government could be seated. He was shot in 1947. And the democratic government came in 1948 and lasted until 1962. So if he had lived, the country might have had a very different future.
The election of the current president is a testament, and the fact that since his first inaugural address and then the subsequent two where he explained the reforms that he wanted, it's a testament to the strength of this democracy, this burgeoning democracy, that this hasn't all collapsed already. And everything I read said, it's going to survive. It's just the pace of how it's going to unwind and roll out. It may be something that we're not accustomed to. Maybe we think it should be faster, and it's going to be different than that.
There are many people who are kind of naive about what democracy entails. I think we take an awful lot of things for granted in our own democracy. Democracy is not the government in Washington. It's really what happens at home. It's
today.
It's right here on the ground, in the town where you live. And you look at how you control your life, your immediate surroundings. We live in a democratic society. We negotiate our differences. We have some control over what the local city does to our property, that sort of thing. In a place like Burma, there's none of that. And so having a stable democracy in a country that's so underdeveloped, both socially and economically, it takes years and years to build the institutions that support a democracy at the top. And that's the challenge right now, to institutionalize democracy as a concept with the people in the country. They don't understand it. As much as the leadership wants the country to be democratic, they don't know what the fundamentals of democracy are. They just can look in a book and say, oh, it takes this kind of a structure of government. That's not what makes democracy. It's the people. And so they have to change the way people think, the way they negotiate their differences. They tend to be much more violent about how they resolve their differences. They're taken to warfare. There are a lot of racial and ethnic differences in the country, and they tend to act out those differences in violent form. They need to learn to negotiate the differences and to build the institutions that allow them to do that, and it's difficult. So that's what U.S. policy now is aimed at, helping them build those institutions. And it's kind of a race against time because they have brought this transition about very fast, raised expectations in the country. In a country like that, most people see the word democracy and they think, oh, American standard of living, that's what democracy means. So what they want is an American standard of living. They don't care about the government. They care about the standard of living. Takes a while to do that. And the question is, can this new government produce an improvement in the standard of living in the country fast enough to satisfy the people with democratic structures? That's the race against time.
My guest, once again, Priscilla Clapp, she's retired minister counselor or ambassador, retired ambassador in the United U.S. Embassy in Burma for 6 years, three of which as chief of mission as ambassador. Mm-hmm. When we return, we'll continue our conversation and we'll bring in a scholar of the role of NGOs in new democracies as well. So stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the future of Burma as a democracy after a long history of military rule. Still with us, Priscilla Clapp. She was a retired ambassador to Burma for 3 years as chief of mission, which is the ambassador. She was there for 6 years. Joining us in a minute, Julia Fisher, author of two books on the nonprofit sector in the third world and its relationship to civil society. Before we moved on, though, Priscilla, I wanted to ask you about the geopolitical issues with Burma. What about the influence of China in the region? What difference does it make now? 50 years ago, it might have meant one thing. Today, it must mean something much different.
Yes, absolutely. You're quite right. 50 years ago, it had to do with the post-colonial period in Southeast Asia, which brought us Vietnam. Burma was going through the same thing. They had a major communist insurgency. The U.S. government was happy to have Burma stay out of the rest of the problems in Southeast Asia, the Indochina Peninsula in particular. And so we supported an isolated country at that time and helped them militarily stave off their communist rebellion. They were handling it on their own. We didn't need to get involved there. That then led to a military coup. Well, it was already a military government at the time, but it led to an isolated military-run country for many years. So it faded off our strategic horizon. It didn't mean much to us. In today's world, particularly with the democratizing Burma that is opening to the outside world, it has the potential to become the hub in that region. It is a country the size of Texas. It's big. It is the largest of the mainland Southeast Asian countries. It sits right between the world's two most populous countries, India and China. Enormous markets, and they covet the wealth of resources that exist in Burma. So it has suddenly become a strategic, potential strategic power in the region.
But is it the sort of strategic power that the United States will get involved in militarily?
No, because it doesn't have external enemies. It doesn't have those kinds of wars to fight. It's a kind of strategic power in an economic sense, not a military sense. And it doesn't really have strategic military value to us. It has strategic political economic value to us. But we haven't seen that in the past. It's only now that it's opening to the outside world, democratizing, facing economic development, could be really dramatic economic development, that it becomes strategic to us. If it had been strategic to us, we would not have had such an onerous sanctions regime on the country for so many years.
I want to bring into the conversation now Julie Fisher. She is author of two books on the nonprofit sector in the third world and its relationship to civil society, political development, and democracy. Her latest book is entitled Importing Democracy, The Role of NGOs in South Africa, Tajikistan, and Argentina. Welcome to the show, Julie.
Thank you.
We were talking... Go ahead.
No, I'm just was going to say I'm looking forward to it. And actually, I have a section in the appendix of my new book about Burma, Myanmar.
We were talking about how U.S. policy is all about helping them build the institutions necessary to sustain this democracy and help it grow. It was noted in one of Priscilla's reports that local social services had not developed over the years because of the nature of the regime. Does this impact the effectiveness of NGOs on the ground in a place like Burma? How does that work?
Well, first of all, I think the premise of my book is that democracies have to be built by people in their own countries. I think we know from Iraq and Afghanistan that exporting democracy militarily doesn't work. But even a lot of attempts to export democracy peacefully, much as we would like to have democracy everywhere, has all kinds of pitfalls. The same reform, if started and initiated locally, has a different political impact than if someone on the outside says, well, you should monitor your elections, or you should, you know, something else. So the book is about what I call democratization NGOs. They're a very special kind of non-governmental organization. But I think the connection between politics and economics that was mentioned a few minutes ago is very important because, for example, in Burma, if I can just return to Burma
for
a minute. There were several so-called border organizations before this big change began. I mean, when democratization was just building on the outside. And there was a group, for example, called Myanmar Egress, a group of business people, journalists, and academics, formed an NGO in 2011. And they were confronting the younger generals in the regime with the notion that Burma was falling behind economically because of its political system. And they were more effective with that message than if they had, you know, gone out and tried to change their minds directly in terms of supporting democracy. So it's an example of how people understand the best way to approach other people in their own countries. And there are many examples in my book about that as well. I noted that your other guest had a was in South Africa in the 90s, just during transition. Am I correct about that?
Priscilla?
Well, yes.
The book is, one-third of the book is about South Africa, and it's the period in the mid-2000s and late 2000s And what happened to these the NGOs in South Africa that were promoting it? One of the most powerful and biggest local democratization NGOs, IDASA, ironically went out of business the very week that my book came out last spring. And the reason was that European economic support declined because of the European economic crisis. But what's interesting is that all of the small democratization NGOs, such as the Good Governance Learning Network, which is a network of local democratization NGOs, have survived and continue. So there are many examples of sort of, preservation and transformation of local energy, as Albert Hirschman called it many years ago. So you don't, even though one particular civil society organization may not last, its progeny remain, as it were.
And that's a major objective, I might add, of U.S. policy and U.S. Assistance now in Burma, is to encourage the development of local civil society and NGO organizations. And the new government has now eased up on the laws so that these organizations can register and become legal, which they weren't before. They used to be persecuted. But there's a very, very lively civil society now in the country, and that's a very good sign. But you're absolutely right about South Africa. That was... it's very sad to see some of these organizations going by the wayside. I'm a little worried about what's happening in that country, frankly.
I'm very optimistic about South Africa, nonetheless, because there are so many of these organizations. And I think the smaller ones may be more nimble. The financial part of maintaining an NGO, an indigenous NGO, is incredibly challenging. And the bigger that it is, the more challenging that it is. So, it may be that smaller democratization NGOs are more able in these countries. I'd like to just give a couple of examples of the kind of work that these NGOs...
You just took the words right out of my mouth. Tell us the difference. We think of NGOs as aid organizations often.
So make
the distinction for us now.
Well, international aid organizations can be official, such as USAID or the official European programs, or they can be international NGOs, such as Save the Children, CARE, those kinds of organizations that many Americans contribute to. All three of my books are about indigenous or local NGOs, which are very different. This book is about NGOs that have a specialty, which is promoting democracy in a very wide way. And I'd like to give some examples from the three countries, if I could. One way in which they promote democratization. And I use that term very carefully because you can't create democracy overnight. It's a long, hard slog. What you can push is democratization. In Argentina, for example, one of the topics that in all three countries is the promotion of law-based civil liberties. Until about 2005 in Argentina, anybody nominated for the Supreme Court by the president had to be, all the president had to do was to send the name over to the head of the parliament, and he would sign off on it. And that would be it. And now, because of the work of a group of democratization NGOs led by a very effective one, the Association for Civil Rights, now it is required, the parliament passed a law, that public hearings be held for all Supreme Court nominees. And a week after this was passed, four sitting Supreme Court justices resigned. So that's an example of the work of NGOs on law-based civil liberty.
There are still lots of negotiations going on in Burma about ceasefires between the various ethnic groups, Priscilla.
Yeah.
And I was wondering, first, Priscilla, tell us how those are going. And then, Julie, when Priscilla's done, can you tell us how those kinds of things can affect the impact of even indigenous NGOs? Priscilla?
The peace negotiations have actually just reached a critical stage. They're at a critical stage right now. The government has been working with 17 of these armed insurgency groups. There are many minority ethnic groups in the country, but 17 of them are armed. And they've been concluding a series of bilateral ceasefire agreements. Now they want to bring it together into a nationwide ceasefire where everybody joins in a single pact. And the groups themselves say, we will do that, but only if you promise to go straight into real peace talks where we resolve our political differences. And the political differences have to do with the degree of autonomy they can have as separate identities inside the country. And the government, the military governments were never willing to do that. They wanted to basically Burmanize them all and bring them into a single, very strong central control. They want more control over their regions, their areas. That is where the government is now. They're about to agree to that set of conditions. And we'll see how this happens. But it's all going to roll out, I think, by the end of this month. They want to have the national level ceasefire conference before the end of this month and then move into peace talks before the end of the year. They have just taken over the seat, the presidency of ASEAN, the regional association, and they want to try and crown their year of the presidency with a major peace agreement in the country. Whether it can be done is still a big question, but they seem to be moving in the right direction now, finally.
And Julie Fisher, how big of a deal is the success of this effort to what NGOs are doing inside the country?
Well, it's huge. I'm a little concerned if they're rushing the process, and I'll tell you why. In my book, I talk about the sustained dialogue that ended the Tajik civil war in the 1990s, and many of the local, it was a civil society dialogue, which happened over 3 years. And as a result of that, they ironed out, they worked through, they were able to really use the magic ingredient of time, 3 years, to hammer out an agreement that was successful for all sides. And then the official negotiators at the United Nations were able to just cut and paste huge sections of this agreement into the official agreement, and that, therefore, went very fast. And I use this, I think this is an important example of what I describe in the book as changing the political culture of a country, which is a very important, another very important role of these democratization NGOs. I would add that, so ending violence, peace efforts, those are all changes in the political culture, just as addressing corruption is, for example, another important issue. This dialogue in Tajikistan ended a civil war that killed 50,000 people. Very few people know about this civil war. And it was sponsored by the Kettering Foundation, which is nearby you all in Dayton. I worked there for 10 years as a program officer. And Kettering has developed, as a result of this process, they developed many materials on this sustained dialogue process, which you can learn about on their website. Mm-hmm. And in addition to public deliberation, which is another process that they promote, this book actually was an outgrowth of my tenure there, and Kettering was very supportive of my work in terms of the ideas in it. So many of the ideas in the sections on political participation and on changing political culture come out of my work at the Kettering Foundation, which is, as I say, in Dayton, very near to you. I would say that if people are interested in this, okay, they could go. Finish?
Yes, sure, go ahead.
Yeah, just to say that my book is available, because I know we're running out of time, on my website, importingdemocracy.org, or through the Kettering Foundation website, kettering.org, or, of course, on Amazon, and it's Importing Democracy.
And we'll have a link to that on our website at WOSU.org. Julie Fisher, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Julie Fisher, she's a scholar and author of Importing Democracy, The Role of NGOs in South Africa, Tajikistan, and Argentina. And Priscilla Clapp, thank you so much for joining us as well. Priscilla Clapp will be speaking at the Ohio Supreme Court's Forum of the Law lecture series today at 6 p.m. For more info on that, you can go to our website at wosu.org/allsides. Thanks again.
Thank you very much. I've had a great time.
Thanks a lot for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.